Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Bianca Bremham.
I'm Jeremy Waltzman.
What? I'm just still me. I'm Lara.
I just thought I'd give it a... just spice it up.
That really caught me off guard, Jeremy.
Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast from the Jackie Winter Group, which is a creative production and representation studio based in Melbourne and New York City. What originally started as a business conference for artists and fellow creatives is now being turned around to shine a light on our clients. From art buyers and creative teams to fellow producers and managers, this podcast is all about offering a glimpse into the work we do as the bridge between clients and creatives. It's an ongoing exploration of how to wrangle the creative process to achieve excellence, no matter what the medium. Today, we pull our colleagues away from their urgent emails to recap their insights from our recent Jackie Winter book club, where each of us reads a different work-related book with the aim of finding some golden nuggets of wisdom which we can share with each other and now with you guys. But before that begins, how is everyone going today?
Yeah, hot still. Always hot, forever hot. There's two dogs in the office. They're all going crazy. Everything's crazy.
I feel like I'm going crazy. My ears have been ringing since I went and saw a rock show last night, and my ears are still ringing.
Tell us about it, Grandma.
How are you, Jeremy?
No, what did you just say? I mean, genuine.
I saw like a jangly New York-based band called Parquet Courts, actually with Arta, who works with me here and in the New York office, which was kind of fun.
Ooh, how was it?
I mean, it was weird, but it was good. It was we had a little mosh. It was fun.
A little mosh. I'm doing very well. We are just preparing for our really exciting dog photog show here at Leamington Drive, where we will be photographing dog portraits. So if you're in Melbourne, come on down and check it out at leamingtondrive.com to get some dog photog by Heather Lighton. Highly recommend. Speaking of dog photog, there's a bit of a whining dog situation at the moment.
I think it's lovely ambiance.
It is lovely. Speaking of ambiance, let's go through some of the links from our professional development Slack. Bianca, you are kicking us off with a piece from Studio Output. I saw this a few weeks, I think, on Swiss Miss. The headline of it is Redesigning Social Platforms for Better Mental Health. This is definitely something that's come up. I think there was that article on Fast Company we were talking about the other week about how people from Facebook were kind of saying that they felt bad about, or well, they had some remorse about kind of the certain things that they were designing to implement to be addictive. And so this is kind of, I guess, looking at things from the other side of things and how we can make things less addictive or better for our mental health. Talk a bit more about this case study. Is this something that's actually kind of happened or more of a proposal?
Well, I mean, it was just a week-long self-initiated research project led by Studio Output, who are a design agency in London. So two of their creatives spent a week trying to kind of understand the evidence that social media use by young people contributes significantly to poor mental health, and then exploring possible design solutions. And it was interesting because, yeah, as you said, it's kind of terrifying how much time and energy, you know, engineers and designers have actually put into making apps addictive and to reel you in. And this exploration, you know, is... It tries to counter some of that addictiveness, and that's interesting to me. And, you know, they kind of came up with a few different concepts, which I'd really love to sort of see explored a little more. And one that I really liked, and, you know, Jeremy, you were sort of talking before about how, or we've talked on the podcast a number of times before about how, you know, if you try and turn off notifications to keep you from being distracted by social media, it just ends up kind of fueling this need to check in on your social media and see what's going on. So one of the kind of things that they came up with was smart notifications. And
I love this screen. It makes so much sense.
Yeah. And you know, I guess batch processing your notifications and giving you the ability to snooze notifications, you know, maybe depending on where you are or like how you're interacting with apps. And yeah, I think that's really interesting to me because I think that, yeah, it would be great to be able to use social media. Like I love being on social media, but I also hate getting into a social media black hole. Yeah.
Well, while you're in that black hole, I will be worshiping inside the First Church of Artificial Intelligence, which is a piece that came up on Wired. Lara, again, as our resident AI expert, take us through what this is about.
This is totally bizarre and totally fascinating and weirdly makes sense to me. I think I might be a convert. So basically, it's a really interesting piece, basically about Anthony Lewandowski, who is a sort of very famous engineer who sort of worked on all sorts of things, including sort of self-driving cars. And he's in the middle of that sort of the lawsuit between, is it Uber and Waymo or whatever it is. And anyway, but basically he has created a new legitimate religion, and it's called Way of the Future. And it's a religion based around respecting and sort of worshipping to an extent artificial intelligence. So I mean, it sounds crazy, but I guess he's coming at it from this perspective where he believes that it's absolutely inevitable that eventually there will be machine intelligence that is far, far smarter than us. And he talks about, you know, what he calls the transition. And he says, you know, humans are in charge of the planet because we are smarter than other animals and are able to build tools and apply rules. But if in the future, if something is much, much smarter, there's going to be a transition as to who is actually in charge. And, you know, what we want is the peaceful, serene transition of control of the planet from humans to whatever. And in, you know, to ensure that the whatever knows who helped it get along. And it's this idea of like, how do we actually maintain a positive relationship with something that's eventually going to rule us and the things that we've created? And it sounds nuts and it sounds kind of like gimmicky, but I don't know, the more and more I read about it, it's, I don't know. It, like, I think there is something to this.
Whatever. I'm going to live forever.
Thanks to AI.
Another thing that came up was the fact that Kickstarter has launched their own patron-based service called Drip. And it was kind of launched by quite a few noted design and, I guess, art and entrepreneurship personalities, including Debbie Millman, who is very well known in the art and design kind of scene. I don't know. Like, I have a lot of mixed feelings about this. Like, obviously, they're kind of trying to get, I'm not going to say bandwagon, but they're definitely kind of obviously trying to compete against Patreon, which we've spoken about here on this podcast before. I mean, look, it's something that I really try to, the whole idea of patronage or kind of getting this kind of core group of fans, I think is something very powerful. And I think we try to make this idea work in different ways, like through the kind of work that we do, whether or not it can, another platform can kind of add something to this conversation. Like, I'm not too kind of sure. Did you guys have any takes on this at all?
Well, I couldn't really see how it really differed itself from Patreon, apart from the fact that it integrates with Kickstarter. And so that they can, I guess they can just leverage Kickstarter's existing audience and brand awareness. That's about it.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it works pretty much the same way. I haven't really kind of seen any kind of differences apart from that they're kind of doing it by invite only at the moment. So, yeah, I mean, it's something to kind of keep an eye on. But at the moment, yeah, it's good to see that the patronage-based kind of movement is getting kind of traction and people realize this is has a business model on both sides of the equation. But yeah, otherwise, I don't know, I'm just going to keep my eyes on it. And finally, the last little piece that has come up is a piece of content from a blog from the Organic Agency, which is, you know, one of these things that I just love. It's called What Do You Do Exactly? The Life of a Creative Producer. But you found this on LinkedIn, your favorite social media platform.
My number
can you tell
one.
Us a bit more about this piece?
Yeah, it was written by, I think, one of their employees, Sarah Cox. And it just kind of, I mean, one of the main reasons we started this podcast was to help give a voice to creative producers, as, you know, it is a role that has up until now been, you know, fairly underrepresented. So it's nice to see other kind of agencies and studios highlighting the value of the role on their own platforms. And yeah, Sarah just kind of, she talks about the difference between a producer and a project manager and, you know, why it's important to have it. And yeah, there was just a few like nice little nuggets. You know, one of the things she said was a good creative producer can turn a project from a messy, clunky journey into a successful project with a great creative outcome that everyone has enjoyed working on. And I think that that's something that is nice to aspire to.
We will put the link to that piece as well as everything else on our podcast website at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz, where our AI overlords can hopefully find a future crumble of that. It's a testament of the good work that we've done here today. You can also sign up to our podcast specific newsletter at tinyletter.com/JackieWinter. Jackie Winter Book Club is basically the same as Oprah's Book Club, just with a few less people, and the books are a lot more related to creative project management and no bees. In a regular book club, you all read the same book, but we're all about maximizing efficiency here at Jackie Winter, so the way we do things is a bit different. In our book club, everyone chooses a different work-related book from a big internal list that we keep updated throughout the year, has an allocated amount of time to read it, and then we all have a big breakfast together where we go over key insights and takeaways, whether the book is worth reading at all. I also kind of bribe everybody by getting to get a personal book of their choice as well, so to read along with their business book. Now, who cares if most of us forgot about book club and speed read our books in the last 2 days? Lara, everyone still came back with some really great tidbits. So today we thought we'd invite each member of the Jackie Winter team to give us the lowdown on what they read, what they learned, and whether you should read it too. It's kind of like a bit of like the Blinkist app, but a bit more focused on, I guess, you know, business and creative project management and that kind of stuff. So I think we'll just get things started. And Lara, maybe we'll begin with you.
Yeah, so my book, I read a book called Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions. And I did read it. I chose it thinking that it was about more sort of consumer and purchaser decisions, when in fact it's really not. It's about the math behind human decision making. I sort of suspect that they put computer science in there to make it sound a little bit more sexy on the shelf, because really math in general tends to put me off anything and everything. But for the most part, the book does tend to sort of skip over the mathematical workings and concentrate on the outcomes and how they're relevant to the kind of decisions that we make in everyday life. And it's that application side that makes it sort of quite an interesting read. And the writing style is fantastic. The author's really witty for a subject matter that's pretty inherently dry. And the text moves at a really good pace, which is really cool because I think it made this sort of content a lot more accessible for me. So basically the book looks at some of the sort of the many problems that we encounter in our daily life. For instance, trying to find a car park, whether you should hold out for something closer or just park in the first one you see, trying new restaurants or sticking to old good ones. What's the fastest way you can sort out the books on your bookshelf, or how can you best sort of schedule the tasks you have to do for sort of maximum productivity, and various other routine problems like that. And the point that the book makes is that although these things are sort of deeply complex human decisions, mathematically they have found, you know, various clear-ish algorithms that, you know, you can use to optimize your results with these sorts of problems. And it's really interesting. I mean, for example, they look at sort of optimal stopping and the explore-exploit problem, and they explain that to someone like me who doesn't give a shit about optimal stopping or the explore-exploit problem. For example, they talk about this whole idea of you should wait till you've been through 37% of your various options and then pick the next one that's better than any that you've seen before. And they go into sort of the reasons why and you know, how that doesn't necessarily work always for actual human life. But it's really interesting. And, I think it's less about actually using the algorithms and more about showing how these really tough decisions in our lives can be simplified to some extent. And I guess realistically, I don't think much of the content of the book will actually change how I do anything, but it's still really interesting. It's potentially practical for someone, you know, who is a practical person. And for me, I just loved how it made something as crap as math so enjoyable.
Would you recommend it?
Yeah, I totally recommend it. I'd recommend it to anyone who has an interest in this sort of algorithmic stuff, but also to people who don't. I think it's a nice entry level, it's not simplistic. It's one of the few sort of business books I've read that doesn't just, it couldn't just be summarized on the blurb. Like, it actually is worth reading the explanations, and they are really witty and clever, and they actually move along when they should. And so, yeah, I definitely recommend the book.
We need to come up with our own star rating for this. What kind of stand-in object do you think we can pick for five instead of stars?
Books.
Book? No, that's not good. Emails?
I said a spring roll.
Spring roll. Potato cakes. How many potato cakes do you give it out of five potato cakes?
Out of five potato cakes, I give it four potato cakes.
Four potato cakes.
God, I would smash four potato cakes right now.
Thank you so much, Lara.
Thank you.
Bianca, you didn't join us for our lovely croissants and sugar-free delicacies the other morning, but you were with us in spirit. Tell us a bit more about the book that you chose.
I read Madison Avenue Manslaughter by Michael Farmer, and This was actually something that you chose for me because I couldn't make a decision myself because I'm decision fatigued.
I don't remember why I chose it, but it's something I bought for myself and I realized I was never going to have the time to read it.
So you delegated.
Like a boss.
So the byline on this is an inside view of fee-cutting clients, profit-hungry owners, and declining ad agencies. So Michael Farmer is the chairman of a strategy consulting firm for advertising agencies and advertisers. And the book chronicles the fall of the advertising industry over, you know, the last maybe 30 or so years, which is mostly a result of agency remuneration moving from commission-based to fee-based, but also due to a couple other things like the rise of holding companies, the empowerment of procurement, the globalization of client relationships, the development of new digital and social media, and then the fragmentation of agency and client relationships. So it kind of starts by talking about, you know, the golden age of Adland, which was sort of the 60s through to the 80s, which was really kind of like, you know, the start of television and like the real kind of like golden creative era of advertising. And back then, agencies were paid on a commission-based structure where they received 15% of the client's media spend for TV, radio, and print. And that commission covered ad creation. And then how much work they actually did was irrelevant to how much they were paid. And then in the 90s, through a number of different reasons, most of the industry moved to a fee-based model, meaning that the agency are paid for the number and cost of people who like are assigned to work on a client's account, plus some additional money for overhead and profit. And in theory, this structure should correlate with the amount of work the agency does, but in reality, it doesn't. So this whole book was hundreds of pages of lots of figures. I found it very difficult to read because it was quite dry and every sentence was just figure after figure after figure. And I found it a little bit difficult to follow, mostly because I don't, you know, I'm not that close to the advertising, like the inner workings of an advertising agency. But I guess one of the things that was interesting was he spoke a lot about the challenge being that a lot of agencies really don't have a system in place for measuring workloads. And a lot of the work that he does with his firm is trying to kind of find a way to measure actually, like how do you measure creative campaigns when they're so different across, you know, different media, different types of clients, all of that sort of stuff. Anyway, I don't know if I would recommend this to anyone that's not a CEO of an agency. I mean, I guess it was like an interesting insight into the world of advertising, and I'd recommend it to someone who's interested particularly in that. But, you know, apart from it kind of giving me a broad overview of the current state of the advertising industry and, you know, a broader understanding of some of the challenge that our clients, so advertising agencies, are facing when they're trying to deliver this work for their clients, it was a little dry. It was too data heavy. I'm so far removed from the inner workings that it was kind of difficult for me to take anything but a general understanding away from it. Like I don't know. That being said, he has a blog, which he updates occasionally, which looks way more interesting, maybe because it's a little bit more specific. But yeah, he kind of writes at the end of the book that really the only people who are in the position to fix anything are those in the C-suite. So this book is really for ad agency CEOs and from the client side CMOs. Like I think you kind of have to be in that position to really kind of get the greatest understanding out of it, or the greatest, get the most out of it.
Cool. Look, thanks very much. We will put the links to this in our show notes as well. And I think we'll move on from there. Thanks, B.
Thank you.
And here to continue the potato cake ranking is Clara Marcus. Tell us about your book. I think of all of the books, you had the strongest opinions on this particular one.
I've actually toned it down a little bit.
Suitable for broadcast.
Yeah.
Okay.
I read Deep Work, Rules for Focused Success in a Distracted Workplace by Cal Newport. And this book basically outlines the difference between shallow work, which is undertaking these logistical, non-demanding tasks, sort of day-to-day work, and deep work, which pushes your cognitive capabilities and requires high concentration. And Cal gives us some examples for ways to successfully add periods of this deep work, high concentration to your routine.
And, you know, why did you choose this book?
I think I chose it because I do find myself sort of flitting between different tasks and I kind of wanted to find a way to really focus. But I don't know if that's really what Cal's trying to tell us here.
What was your biggest takeaway?
There are some interesting ideas around sort of creating a specific routine for deep work that I think are quite interesting. So sort of moving away from your normal workspace, going somewhere totally different. I kind of was interested in the idea of this like financial investment. So he was talking about this example of J.K. Rowling writing Harry Potter and going to this like super expensive hotel to like force herself to write loads.
Tell me something.
This guy did create this cool like cabin in the woods. So, you know, we could give that a go. But yeah, I think really one of the things that I found wasn't super applicable to us is that Cal's view of shallow work encompasses most day-to-day communication tasks, which is really kind of a pretty solid chunk of what we do as producers. So his deep work philosophy is only really applicable to a very small amount of what we do.
There was some other weird part of the book that you didn't really like.
Yeah, he said a few weird things about social media, which were just pretty outdated. He kind of had this whole thing where he was talking about how relationships created online were lightweight. He kept using the word lightweight a lot.
Very strange. So I think overall, not a real huge recommended book.
No.
I think it's tough because for people like us who rely on email as our primary, I think email is just not really conducive to deep kind of work. And so I think that's where there's a bit of conflict maybe.
Exactly. I feel it was maybe my error in choosing this book without reading the blurb probably.
How many potato cakes do you give this out of 5 potato cakes?
5?
Yeah.
1.5.
1.5 potato cakes.
One okay. Seems too cruel.
Well, thank you very much, Clara. I appreciate that. We will keep this on the bookshelf to stare at because it is a very bright yellow cover.
Thank you.
Cheers. Making her debut appearance on the podcast is our gallery and office manager, Sheena Jameson. Sheena, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing very good. So happy to have you here. Clara was just saying it's easier the second time. It definitely is a bit hard the first time, but let's get stuck into your book. What book did you read? Give us a 30-second blurb.
I read Unsubscribe, How to Kill Email Anxiety, Avoid Distractions, and Get Real Work Done by Jocelyn K. Gly, who was the former founding editor of 99u.com.
Awesome.
Cool website, yeah. For creatives. it consists of 4 main parts: psychology, strategy, and style. And then there's a chunk at the back with like a cheat sheet email or scripts or something.
And why did you choose this book?
Because I am someone that suffers from email anxiety. and I'm always trying to get to inbox zero constantly throughout my day. And yeah, this book put that into perspective for me a bit.
Excellent.
Yes.
What was your biggest takeaway, do you think?
My main takeaway was in the strategy section and just about crafting a new daily email routine. So that's like not looking at email first thing when you get into the office, but blocking out the first 30 to 60 minutes straight up for meaningful work. And then also batching your emails into 2 or 3 like larger chunks of time rather than keeping your inbox open at all and visible throughout the workday. Each time we flip back and forth from task to task, we incur a switching cost, apparently, which she says can take around 25 minutes to probably get back onto a task. So you have to refocus and you're not being effective.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because we just spoke to Clara who, you know, I think had a pretty negative reaction to her book, but like also kind of trying to deal with the same things in terms of, yeah, trying to focus and keep deep focus and as being something that we should kind of strive for, but how email is not a very good medium to do that with. And I like the fact that this book kind of takes it as a given that most people have to work kind of in email most of their jobs and most of their day. And so this is just kind of is saying, okay, well then how can kind of we work with email as a medium, imperfect as it is, to do those things. What kind of person do you think would you recommend this book to?
I would definitely recommend it. I think it was like super easy to read. It was like only 200 pages long and it was broken up with lots of illustrations that like made these little key chunks of the preceding text like really palatable, and like for a visual learner it was really good to kind of get that reinforcement.
Interesting. We're rating everyone's book out of potato cakes. Out of 5 potato cakes, how many potato cakes do you give Unsubscribe?
Oh, I would give it 4 potato cakes.
4 potato cakes. Good work. Thanks so much, Sheens.
Thank you.
Cheers. Bye. Joining us again is our producer Micah Parrow. Micah, what book did you read for book club?
This time around, I actually went for an audiobook called The Secrets of Closing the Sale by Zig Ziglar.
Give us a bit of a 30-second blurb about the book.
So pretty much he kind of ran through the personality traits it takes to be a good salesperson and the type of relationship you should try and garner with your prospect, which is what he refers to as your client and buyer the whole way through, all the while in a pretty hilarious southern drawl and so many anecdotes that you kind of lose track completely.
Why did you choose this book?
So I don't think that selling comes supernaturally to me. So I'm thinking about that. And then you recommended maybe have a go at Zig Ziglar. So yeah, pretty much just kind of get a bit more confidence in being a salesperson.
Interesting. And yeah, like I honestly read any of his books, but it came up on a few kind of internet communities that I kind of read. And this is kind of where we kind of populate the list from. And I think this is one of the best things about kind of book club as well, is that like, you know, we can keep this kind of this big list of kind of titles that we kind of keep seeing kind of come up and just kind of get a bit of a top level overview from there from everybody. So, you know, what was your biggest takeaway from, I guess, listening to his story?
I think the main takeaway was the idea of selling as an assistant buyer. So he talks a lot about the idea of crossing the table and being on the buyer's side and making it easy for the buyer to buy. So this is kind of something he refers to all the way through and is a thought that he finds profound. He had quite a few profound points throughout.
In air quotes.
Yes. And the way he said it very slowly, profound. So basically this covered things like making it easy for the prospect to buy by persuading rather than convincing. So that persuading is, you know, by asking questions. And under this topic, he spoke a lot about, as I said, crossing the table and like selling being a transference of feelings. So if you're excited about your product, that excitement will travel over to your prospect and make, you know, them more likely to buy. And yeah, to round that off, he also went into the idea that the buyer must buy you before they'll buy your product, which I think is something we really work hard at in terms of making a good relationship with our clients so that they come back. And also the idea of keeping a name in front of them, even between sales, like we're not directly selling to them, but still having an open line of communication, which we do a lot, you know, through events or newsletters and go-sees. So I think a few of those points really correlated well in.
Awesome. Yeah, like I think that, you know, we're not kind of typically a sales kind of heavy business. But yeah, one of the things I like trying to do with this is, you know, learn from kind of other disciplines. So yeah, there are definitely some things that kind of reinforce some of the things we do, knowing that we're on the right track. But yeah, I also felt that, you know, there's some of the basics, like, you know, working with our clients a bit more kind of alongside them and not kind of in this kind of opposition. I thought there was some interesting perspective there that you raised in book club. Would you recommend this?
It was a little bit outdated, but did have some good kind of nuggets of advice and information. I would definitely recommend it as an audiobook rather than reading it, just for his amazing accent and the terribly, terrible 80s intro music to each chapter.
Okay, we're rating this on a scale of 5 potato cakes. How many potato cakes do you give it?
I give it 2.5 potato cakes.
2.5 potato cakes. Excellent. Going in the ledger. Micah, thank you very much. We'll see you in a few minutes, actually.
No worries.
Okay, also making her debut appearance on the podcast is Melissa Van Dartel, our special projects manager and all-around amazing person. Mel, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime. Now, what book did you read for book club?
I read How to Be a Productivity Ninja by Graham Alcott.
Is that why you're wearing all black today?
Yes. Excellent. And this face covering.
And so give us a bit of a 30-second blurb about what this is all about.
So the book outlines ways to organize your work and how to make the best out of different states of attention. It goes through organizing your inbox, lists and checklists to help you manage stress and your own and others' expectations. And there are exercises you can do scattered throughout the book, but I didn't do any of them.
Why did you choose the book?
I chose it because of the name, but if I hear Productivity Ninja one more time, I think I might scream.
They sprinkled it liberally throughout the entire book, didn't they?
It was a heavy sprinkling, like when you realize you've put too much salt on your dinner.
I mean, what was kind of your biggest takeaway? Obviously, there's, I think, some tips that were pretty fairly kind of common sense, but is there anything that you think, you know, you or we could integrate into our workflow at all?
Well, I got halfway through the book and he was talking about rearranging your email inboxes to sort of have three folders, but I only did it into two. So it was action, so things that you need to action that can't be done in sort of 2 minutes and less, and waiting, so a folder where you've actioned your part but you're waiting for someone to come back to you, so you don't really want to archive it, so you sort of know that it's there so you don't forget about it. He also suggested a read folder, but we don't really send out big long emails to each other. We sort of all chat on Slack, so there's nothing really that I wanted to put in that folder.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be a common thread through so many of these books. It's like, you know, yeah, there's always this kind of thing about attention, but yeah, then there's always kind of these, everyone's kind of got their own system. And I think it turned out, again, this was in some ways kind of backing up or kind of further endorsing kind of some of the systems that we use with kind of task managers like Wunderlist and things like that. But sometimes it's just a matter of just trying of reading them over and over from kind of different perspectives. Sometimes you can get a new take on it. I mean, is this something that you would recommend to someone else?
I think, like, I sort of wish the book was a lot shorter. It sort of got a bit repetitive and there was some stuff in there that just, I mean, it wasn't useful for what we do here, but yeah, it's got good bits in it, and I think it's good to sort of read through these sorts of books to sort of just remember your systems that you have and maybe rejig them a bit to sort of make things work better. But yeah.
What kind of person do you think you'd recommend this to?
Someone that had a lot of email folders like me. Yeah, it was a good reminder book. I wish it was a bit shorter, but it was a good reminder book of processes to sort of put in place to sort of help you manage all your tasks and everything like that.
Excellent. Well, we're doing a bit of a rating on a potato cake scale out of 5 potato cakes. How many potato cakes do you give this?
How crispy are the potato cakes?
I would say medium crispy.
Okay. 3.5 potato cakes.
3.5 potato cakes. Thank you so much, Mel.
Thank you.
Also, making her first appearance of the podcast is our social media marketing manager, Penny Wilson. Penny, how are you?
I'm very good.
Thank you so much for joining us. Tell us what book you read for book club.
Okay, so I read Drive by Daniel H. Pink.
Yes.
And I guess it's all about how important it is to be intrinsically motivated, so self-motivated, by your work these days.
And why did you pick this book?
I picked it because I guess during book clubs, I tend to be fairly drawn to like psychological books, not only because it interests me personally, but also because as a person who's creating content, I want to know what's going to interest our audience. And I don't know, it sounds a little bit sort of devious to be like, oh, I want to get into their minds. But yeah, I think having a knowledge of psychology is a good way to be like a social media marketer.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you spoke pretty passionately about the book. You know, obviously it's hard to kind of summarize or get those, you know, takeaways immediately. But I mean, what were some of the biggest takeaways that you kind of wanted to communicate to the rest of the group here for our work?
One of the biggest takeaways that I got from this, especially something that's very relevant to the creative industry, is the quickest way our intrinsic motivation is stifled is when we're not feeling like we're being paid adequately. So David, the author, argues that, you know, we need to make sure that our artists are being paid fairly so that they're not worried about paying the bills or, you know, how much is coming into their bank account. And not worrying about that allows enough space for them to open up creatively, you know, and produce work that's more than just a means of getting from A to B.
Amazing. Is there anything else that was a key point that stuck out to you?
So one thing that they did introduce, the whole book is speaking about people in different mindsets. So in the book they say that people are type X or type I mindsets. What they're really talking about is this idea of, and I think this is fairly well known, this idea of either having a fixed mindset or a growth mindset. So either saying like, oh, a fixed mindset would say, these are my abilities and that's it. A growth mindset would think, I can't do this yet, but with enough training or enough development, I will be able to. So that was a really important part of, you know, being intrinsically motivated, is having a growth mindset and knowing that you might not be able to do something right away, but if you put in the effort, yeah, you will be able to eventually.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I think really kind of cuts across like lots of different levels of seniority. Like, I think I put it on the list because I was reading it as a great kind of management book to kind of understand, you know, how to work with, I guess, the motivation of all of the staff who work here. But then I think all the staff can read it as well to get a better feel for the artist and you yourself, especially. And that's a big part of what you do. So, I mean, would you recommend this, and would you recommend it to?
Absolutely. I would definitely recommend it. I mean, basically to everyone, but especially people in managerial positions. Definitely in terms of like our industry, producers, really to get across, to get an idea of, you know, how we can all work together to like make sure that we're all staying motivated and making sure that, yeah, everyone's feeling good about what they're doing.
Awesome. Out of 5 potato cakes, how many potato cakes do you give Drive?
I think, oh man, I'd rate it pretty highly. I would say like 4.5 potato cakes.
It was good. Okay, good stuff. As good as a potato cake?
Nah, nothing's as good as a potato cake.
Thanks so much, Pen.
Awesome, thanks.
Okay, I thought we were done addressing all of our, all of our first-time podcast guests, but here we have Coco. And Lee, tell us about your book. What did you choose for book club?
So my choice was Redesigning Leadership by John Maeda. John comes from a background in design and computer science as a practitioner and a professor, but he was thrown into leadership at the Rhode Island School of Design. And so really this book is just all about his insights into creative leadership.
And why did you choose this book?
Well, I thought, you know, the idea of leadership is something that I've always been interested in, is to tactics of how to manage that and lead people. But, you know, his aspect of in employing his design background into that was interesting. But unfortunately, I didn't really enjoy this book.
It was a bit disappointing. I mean, I think I'm able to hear. I mean, John is, a kind of personal icon of mine. He wrote an amazing book in 1999 called Design by Numbers. And I think it was one of the first people to kind of apply computer programming to design and kind of looking at generative art and things like that. And yeah, he's had a string of amazing appointments since then. But yeah, why do you think, this missed the mark for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the style of it was not really my cup of tea, because the way that it was organized was through a series of tweets, really, and then fleshing out those points of those tweets.
It was a small book.
It was a very small book, so I feel like I cheated the book club a little bit, because I did order the book and get it in the mail and go, oh, it's like 200 pages or less. but yeah, I guess, you know, really the key takeaway of the book that I found was that through his being thrown into leadership, he really discovered that the way to lead people is through communication and use a human approach, which is something I kind of have figured out already. And that's why I think a lot of the people in our field of work who are constantly working with people and trying to get them to, do certain tasks or move the dial further towards the goalpost. You have to be a human and communicate with people to get them to do what you want.
Seems so simple, but also really hard.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. So I guess him just sharing those insights, who knows, it could really help somebody who's been in a leadership position and never really dealt with teams before. So that's who I'd recommend it to. But for people who are project managers and have been that for quite a while, probably not for you.
Excellent. How many potato cakes out of 5 potato cakes do you give
this? Oh, I wonder what I get for 5 potato cakes. Maybe 2.
2 potato cakes.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's not too bad, but
there's a really great spread over here.
Of potato cakes?
Of potato cakes.
Do we get to eat them?
No.
Damn it.
Thank you so much, Lee.
Thanks,
you, Coco.
Jeremy.
Bye. Finally, lucky last, we welcome back to the podcast, Jess Harris. Jess, How are you?
Oh, so great, Jeremy. How are you?
Good. So good to see you. You're wearing all black and you're blending in with our black background. So I just see a floating head. It's quite bizarre.
Same with you.
What book did you choose for book club?
I chose 12 Elements of Great Managing by Todd Wagner and James Harter, which is an American title.
And give us a bit of a 30-second overview.
Mm-hmm. Wagner and Harter's 12 Elements were compiled using like the Gallup kind of employment analysis, which I think was like 10 million interviews that they conducted. And it kind of talks about the degree to which a company adopts and commits to 12 elements as a direct predictor of performance in a company.
Cool. And yeah, what kind of called to you to make you choose this book?
Well, I don't know if this insight came about when we last spoke, but I am pretty into psychology and like how it impacts us. So I feel like a lot of these elements pretty much come down to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So one of the most powerful elements in this book as it relates to production and management is esteem. It's also one of the hardest for us to remember to do, as all humans naturally revert to a negative bias, like thanks to our, you know, ancestors who were using their survival instincts. So the importance of employees feeling recognized by their team, you know, which like gives you a boost of dopamine, is imperative to successful and happy people. So I really took that away that like, yeah, it's as little as giving a compliment, which like, you know, is a powerful indicator for a company to be successful, like acknowledging their staff.
Well, yeah, I think there's a kind of a through line here that a lot of people are interested in the psychology aspect of things. And I think, yeah, to be a good producer, you are kind of a therapist and psychologist and a million other things at the same time. So for sure.
Totally.
What was your biggest takeaway? Like, what do you think was the most useful thing you picked up that, you know, would have been of most use to the rest of the team?
I think like utilizing those esteem techniques and then just being reminded that so much of like what we discuss, especially in production, does come down to like those kind of really basic needs for you know, like praise and support and empathy and patience with others, I think, and that directly correlates to like a happy team.
Yeah. Interesting. Is this something that you would recommend, and who would you recommend it to?
I'd definitely recommend it, but I'd recommend it for people who are either new to business or small business owners that are in like high turnover categories like retail and hospitality, or even agencies where sometimes there's 20 people involved in a project, but you know, you still need to remember to like look after every single person involved, not just treat them as a group.
Interesting. And we're rating this out of potato cakes. How many potato cakes out of 5 potato cakes would you give this?
I'd recommend it 3 potato cakes.
Three potato cakes. Interesting. We've gone from 1.5 to 4.5, and I think almost everything in between.
That's
so
a good range.
There are a lot of half potato cakes being left around though. but no, really interesting. And I think, you know, look, kind of taking stock over everyone's book as we were kind of discussing, and I've said this a few times now, is that a lot of this stuff is kind of really basic. And I think there's so much kind of content out there, you know, in, you know, whether it's kind of online Medium articles or books themselves, like everyone's kind of looking to just kind of extract that juice there, because you know, because it's there's not enough time to kind of read or get all this kind of information, and especially if you want to kind of keep yourself educated and kind of keep ahead of the curve. And I think, yeah, it always comes down to like, you know, just doing the simple things and kind of just doing them right and doing them well. Like, there is no kind of magic formula kind of from any of these books, but I think it's just nice to kind of revisit them and kind of be reminded of them every once in a while. And I think, yeah, it's all about kind of that, you know, to use a pretty overused word, but that mindfulness, like of those kind of simple things and how that can really take you far.
Yeah, definitely. Because I think we have to appreciate that although it's a simple act, the power that it has on the person receiving it can be like exponential.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to say you've done a great job, Jess.
Oh, that's
thank you so
very
much.
Kind. Thank you. You too, Jeremy.
Thanks for participating. And yeah, I'll see you soon. And that was the end of our complete roll call here for Book Club. Fascinating stuff, everyone. Wrapping up like we try to do every week is the most Melbourne and most New York thing that we've seen this week. Lara, you once again are going to be going up north to Sydney to give us the most Sydney thing
of
the week.
Sometimes more just happens in Sydney than it does in Melbourne. So I've got a Sydney thing yet again. This is I don't know if I'm angry or fascinated or what. There is a 10 square meter studio apartment in Paddington, which for people who haven't been to Sydney is one of Sydney's sort of most upmarket areas. 10 square meter studio on the market for $320,000.
Bagging.
That is bonkers to me. It's basically a cupboard. So there's no like proper kitchen. There's a photo. God, we have to link to this because there's a photo and the bed is like on a little loft, like a little bunk bed because you can't even fit a bed in there. The whole thing is crazy, but apparently it's like one of a slew of places just like this that have sold for around the same price.
Well, speaking of overpriced small real estate, Bianca, what have you seen in New York? I'm sure this is not a new concept for you.
This is definitely not a new concept. Gosh, I mean, I'm about to move apartments and I need to buy a wardrobe because my wardrobe is about the size of 4 coats. But no, what have I seen lately? I went to a friend's turn 26 over the weekend and he threw a bar mitzvah, which I guess is the 13-year anniversary of his bar mitzvah. So I have never been to a bar mitzvah, so that was kind of fun. We wore kippahs and we ate a lot of babka.
That's fantastic. I took a trip to the RMIT Design Archives last week, which was an amazing experience. It was like, it's a crazy building. And if anyone's ever seen The Leftovers, most of The Leftovers was filmed in Melbourne the last season, which was the best. Was lots of scenes in there because it's kind of like this crazy bunker, but also kind of ironically part of the new design building, which has been plagued by design problems. And while I was there in the archives, we were in this really elevated section that had shelves that probably went, I don't know, maybe like 100 feet high. It was so high that I would not recommend, I don't even know if they make ladders that tall. And they just built shelves that went all the way to the ceiling. And they were just kind of empty. And we were just talking about how this was a very Melbourne thing in terms of making this huge archive and this huge building to design, but just also, you know, being plagued by design problems, including really high shelves that nobody could reach. It was funnier in person.
I can't even reach regular shelves.
Okay.
That's why I got a tall boyfriend.
Thank you very much, Lara.
Thank you.
Thank you, B.
Thank you.
This has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast about creative project management and production and just making things happen in general. Our producer is Areej Noor. You can find the Jackie Winter Group on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc. at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And you can email us with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Archives of all of our shows and show notes can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. And you can also sign up to our podcast-specific newsletter at tinyletter.com/jackiewinter, where we send out our show notes every week and let you know when the episode is ready to be downloaded. Our theme music is by Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/jackiewinter. If you love what you hear, you can help us out by subscribing on iTunes, rating us, and give us a bit of a comment. It helps more people find the show. Details are on our website at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye-bye. She thinks I'm in-